Well, it's a great pleasure to have Tim Crane here today, and indeed to have, I guess, what we'll have, I was hoping for, The Intentionalist Strikes Back, but we have quite a long title on the relationship between the phenomenal qualities of experience and the qualities of the objects of experience. But I'm sure that in the process we'll be able to better understand exactly where Tim's views are now grown or situated in relation to those of the projects. Tim, I'm just going to turn that over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dan. Yes, this being the phenomenal qualities project, I thought I'd put the word phenomenal qualities in the title of my talk as a mark of respect. I could have called it something else. I could have called the talk The Given. In fact, I might call it that, The Given. I'm very happy to be following on from Sam's talk, because the first few things I want to say are actually very close to what Sam was saying at the end of his talk, or in the middle of his talk, actually, about the transparency of experience. So I've tried to defend an intentionalist conception of experience. I think that experience is a form of intentionality, the mind's directness upon its objects, or mental representation. I've tried to defend that view in a number of places, but I completely agree with Sam that the argument from the so-called transparency of experience is not a good argument. It's not even very clear what the phenomenon is supposed to be, and I've rejected that elsewhere in print. But let me just pick up on the very same quote that Sam was talking about. It's a quote from Michael Tye's paper, Visual Qualia and Visual Content, from the 1992 book. And he says, when one tries to focus in on experience of blue in introspection, one cannot help but see right through it, so what one ends up attending to is the real colour blue. Now, this presents a view of the phenomenal qualities of experience which some intentionalists put forward explicitly, which is that the phenomenal qualities of experience are the qualities of the objects of experience. And that's some externalist intentionalists express their view that way. But it can't be right as simply stated like that, as for the reason that Sam said, because if this were so, then all introspectable experiences would involve relations to real objects and real instances of properties. But that's not the case. So we believe that there are experiences, well, and this is a disagreement with Sam, of course, but there are experiences which do not involve relations to real instances of properties. So if, you know, after stimulating my retina with a picture of the American flag in appropriately contrasted colours, then I stare at a white wall and it seems that the American flag is on that wall. There is no American flag on the wall, there's no redness on the wall, and I say there's no redness anywhere. So there's no relation to any red, there's no relation to any property of redness in this case. So Tye is wrong to say, when he says in the later writing, that the qualities to which we have direct access are qualities of external things. There's a very perverse way of getting around that appeals to awareness of uninstantiated qualities, which I can mention if you want, but it seems to me a purely scholastic response. So what intentionalism actually says, and this is what Tye says earlier on in the early paper, is what is one aware of when hallucinating are specific aspects of the content of experience. This is what he actually says, and that was the remark that Sam, that I was describing when I described Tye's view, when I said that you're aware the experience represents that the ocean is blue. And since you're in the same state of mind, according to the intentionists, when you're aware of something real and when you're not, this state of mind is the same. So that's what you're aware of when you're in introspection, when you're perceiving. So broadly speaking, that stepping back from the thesis that the phenomenal properties of the experience are the properties of external objects, rather intentionalism says that the phenomenal properties of experience are understood in terms of the representation of properties of the objects of experience, even if there are no such objects or no such properties. And I think this is how we should understand charitably the idea that introspection reveals awareness only of the content of experience. However, this just raises a question: the what on earth is meant by the content of experience? And that's going to be actually the main focus of my talk today. What can and should and must be meant by the term content of experience? I'm assuming here that the content of experience is something distinct from the object of experience, and this is a distinction with a more distinguished lineage than most ideas in these areas that goes back to Twardowski and Husserl, and that we should distinguish between the object of experience in the sense of what is seen, which is something that transcends the mental state itself. Well, this was Husserl's view in his early view in the logical investigations. And we distinguish that thing, which is something which has a life independently of the experience itself, from the content of the experience, which is, as I'm going to put it, the way the object of the experience is represented. So I'm distinguishing those two things, and here's my illustration of this Gainsborough drawing of his cat. The same thing represented in different ways. It's just that's my piece of eye candy, so Sam. Perhaps this is more appealing. I don't know. Now, so in order to answer this question, what is meant by the content of experience, I had to do some research, which of course means going to the Stanford Encyclopedia first and Wikipedia second when the Stanford Encyclopedia gives out. And it turns out that on the Stanford Encyclopedia there is an article called The Contents of Experience by Susanna Siegel, who counts, I think if anyone does, as being an expert on this subject. And Siegel says that the content of an experience is what is conveyed to the subject by her perceptual experience. Now, the question then about what the content of experience is the question, what is it that is conveyed to the subject by perceptual experience? I just use as a variant of that what is given to the subject in experience. So something that's conveyed to you is something that's given to you. And since I think, in the case of experience anyway, there's no giving without taking, I will also talk about what the subject takes in experience. The question, what is given by experience, is my question. Now, this notion of what is given in experience, that's the way I'm understanding the word content of experience, right? Content isn't a term that has a proper use, or no one can claim the right to use this word in a certain way. This is a term of philosophical art, and different artists use it in different ways. So there is no proper use. Just as I disagree with Galen here, there's no proper use for the word representation or representationalism. These are just terms of art that can be defined in certain ways. And as long as we're clear about what it is that we mean by these terms, then we're entitled to use them as we like. Nonetheless, there is a question, a real question, not just a terminological question, about what is conveyed to the subject in an experience. And one of the reasons why the philosophy of perception is so difficult, that there seem to be real questions about this. And in fact, these correspond to other uses of the word content in earlier writings on this subject. In some earlier writings, people talked about the contents of consciousness. So in late 19th century and early 20th century writings, many philosophers would talk about content being the contents of consciousness, and that content then is the sensory dimension of experience. So that people can talk about things like qualitative content, and that's all that qualia really means, the qualitative content of experience. There's a nice book by Bernard Harrison from the 70s, which is rather neglected now, which is entirely about the inverted spectrum problem called Form and Content. And he takes that from a title of an essay by Schlick called Form and Content. But it begins with what would be an unintelligible remark if today's use of the word content was the only way to use the word, which is that Heron Harrison said, it is often held that language can express only the form, but not the content of experience. Which is, these days, of course, people think of content as the propositional content of experience. And of course, if I perceive that Paul is eating a biscuit, that's something that I can, that what I perceive, the content of what I, of my experience, is something that I can put into words. And so what does it mean to say language can express only the form but not the content of experience? Well, Schlick said in his paper that there is no proposition about content. There cannot be any. Because content here is the ineffable sensory element which remains, which is what changes across imagined inverted spectrum situations. So this is not just a terminological warning about how to read earlier writers, but it's also an indication that for these writers, the content in their sense was what was given to the subject. The sensory element, the sensory dimension, the qualitative element, was what was given to the subject. Or part of what was given to the subject, the ineffable part. Today's answer is different, and as Sam has explained a bit this afternoon, that people talk in terms of representational content. So when you ask what is given to, and this is actually what Siegel's article is about, it's purely about the representational content of experience, how an experience represents the world to be. Representational content is defined as a state with accuracy conditions. So when you can say that the state, there is a condition on the accuracy of the state for it being inaccurate or inaccurate, that's its representational content, according to Tai, one of the leading intentionalists. So this is what I'm saying. Content is a term of art. There isn't an intuitive answer to the question, what is content? But there are intuitive answers, and there are conflicting answers to the question, what is conveyed or given to a subject in the subject by an experience? And what I want to say is that there's nothing obvious, there's not supposed to be anything obvious about the intentionalist's definition of what is given to the subject as representational content. This is a thesis, it's not supposed to be something obvious. What I'm calling the standard intentionalist view says that the content of an experience is propositional. And all I mean by that is that it's propositional is content that can be true or false. So a proposition is something that is true or false. And so if you say an experience has propositional content, you say that the experience represents the world in a certain way, which is either true or false. And that's the what I'm calling the standard intentionist view. And here's a quote from Alex Byrne, another representative figure here, where he says, all parties agree that perceiving is much like a traditional propositional attitude, such as believing or intending. So the term propositional attitude was Russell's term for states of mind which have a propositional content, where we can say that there's, you know, if you believe that Mongolia had the second largest empire in the history of the world, that's something that you believe, that's a proposition, it's something that can be true or false, it's actually true if Wikipedia is to be believed. And that's something that you stand in the believing relation to, and this is the standard way of thinking of propositional attitude. So standard intentionalism says that perception is a propositional attitude. When one has a perceptual experience, one bears the perception relation to a certain proposition, so says Byrne. A brief footnote, which I'll come back to later. There will be a certain kind of flat-footed Wittgensteinian response to this, would be say that, or more of an ordinary language approach, where you say, now you're saying that you perceive propositions, but how can you perceive propositions? After all, propositions are abstract objects, these can't be perceived, the view is incoherent. The view is not that you perceive propositions in the sense that you perceive cows or sheep or pigs. Clearly, if anyone thought that, the view wouldn't be worth discussing. The idea is that there is, in this part of the theory of mental states, that we can think of what it is to perceive things in the world is to be analysed in terms of some kind of representation of those things, which you think of as standing in a relation to a proposition, rather as what is it to believe that Mongolia had the second largest empire in the history of the world, is to represent that the world is a certain way, which you think of as standing in the belief relation to a proposition, and there are various reasons that I don't want to go into for treating things in that way. So the view isn't that you perceive propositions. Now what I'm going to... I want to adopt an intentionalist conception of experience. I want to defend it, but I want to reject this, what I'm calling the standard intentionist view. Now one of the problems with philosophy is that once someone says something, a lot of people think that they understand what they're saying, and then they run away with the ball and play with the ball on its own with that particular understanding, and it all takes on a life of its own. I suppose what I'm saying is rather something, expressing some sympathy with what Galen said this morning about how terminology can get out of hand, but I also think that ideas can get out of hand. And so what happened in the philosophy of perception in recent years was that, well, people said perception is a propositional attitude. Well, that then we can investigate that further in the way that we investigate propositional attitudes by asking what kind of proposition is it an attitude to? And there are a number of different approaches to this. For example, of what propositions are. And there's a famous dispute between Russell and Frege, where Russell said in a letter to Frege that, that Mont Blanc, with all its snowfields, is a constituent part of the thought that Mont Blanc is more than 4,000 metres high. And Frege denied this. He said that it is not. Mont Blanc, with all its snowfields, is not part of the thought that Mont Blanc is over 4,000 metres high. And this gives rise to the distinction between the Russellian and the Fregean conception of propositions, where for Frege these were composed of senses, that is to say modes of presentation of things in the world, whereas for Russell they were composed of things in the world themselves. I'm not going to go into the reasons for that, but that's the reasons are incredibly important in the debates at the time that were responsible for the origins of what then came to be called analytical philosophy. In later semantic views, you get what's called known as the Lewis-Starnacker approach to propositions, where you think of a proposition as a set. You think of it as a set of possibilities or a set of possible worlds. So you think that the proposition that Mongolia had the second largest empire in the history of the world can be thought of as the set of all those worlds in which Mongolia had the second largest empire in the history of the world. Now, the point of saying that is, in effect, you give the truth conditions of the proposition. Truth conditions of that sentence are given by that set of worlds. And that sentence then is true just in case the actual world is a member of that set. Now, that's a way of doing semantics, where semantics is the systematic study of the semantic properties of languages, and you semanticists approach this by assigning parts of the language different kinds of entities, and those entities behave in certain systematic ways, and you can compute the truth or falsehood of complex linguistic representations in terms of the semantic properties of their parts, and this is what these kind of objects are for. Nonetheless, when people started saying that perception was a propositional attitude, then they started talking about the kinds of propositions that might be the objects of these attitudes. And people would dispute about whether you should have a Russellian conception of the content of perception or a Fregean conception. Now, why I say this is like running away with the ball and playing with it, it's like people didn't know what perception was, then someone said, ah, it's a propositional attitude, and said, oh, now we know how to deal with that. We'll have the debate about propositions and what kind of propositions they are. Others have said that there can't be a real debate here, and that we should, in fact, there are many reasons for adopting the different conceptions of propositions, and we should adopt a pluralist conception. And here's I won't read that out. This just says that this is a quotation from a much discussed essay by David Chalmers, where he says that you should be a pluralist about representational content. And he means that for experiences too. And the thing I want to emphasize is this, that a given experience may be associated with multiple representational contents via different content relations. So you can think that an experience might have a Russellian content, it is representing the world in one kind of way, might have a Frege content representing the world in another kind of way. There isn't really a real question about whether the content of experience as such is Fregean or Russellian. Now, when you read Chalmers on this, it's actually quite persuasive, and it doesn't seem like it's a real issue. Nonetheless, well, when I say it doesn't seem like a real issue, there seems to be something, a lot to be said for this content pluralism, if you think of things in that way. But my question is, what's this got to do with the given? What's this got to do with what is conveyed to the subject in an experience? And I think here I am unintentionally responding to some of the things that Sam was criticizing about intentionalism. So if content pluralism is true, if you can have all these different kinds of propositional contents associated with one experience, where does this leave the idea of content as what is given to the subject by their experience? Should you say that multiple representational contents are given to the subject by their experience? Should you say that sets of possible worlds are given to the subject by their experience? Or should we say that that we should have all of these things? What should we say? Well, you might say, well, that's irrelevant, because all we're doing here is we're just talking about the semantic structure of sentences which ascribe perceptual states to people. But that can't be the whole story, because if we look back to the Stanford Encyclopedia Oracle again, that Siegel says that it's another commonly held constraint, she says, on a theory of perception, perceptual content, is that contents must be adequate to its phenomenology of experience. The notion of phenomenal adequacy has considerable intuitive force. This suggests that the contents of experience have to in some way reflect the phenomenology of the experience. Well, this is very strange, because we started off with this idea that the content was what was given or conveyed to the subject by an experience. Now, what is that, if not a phenomenological claim? Given, it doesn't mean what's given in, just in the sense of, you know, I don't know. What could conveyed mean if it doesn't mean conveyed to the conscious subject? In other words, something which is phenomenologically available. So how can it then be a further question whether your description of the content is phenomenologically adequate? This is, as it were, an optional add-on that you could give to your account.
I don't understand it at all.
You don't understand what she's saying?
No.
Okay.
Great, thank you.
In what sense? You mean in the sense that I said very strange? I said this is a very strange thing to say. I say, given that you introduced the notion of content as what is conveyed to the subject by their experience.
No, I understand that. I just don't know what her words mean. Doesn't matter.
Well, I think this is something that needs diagnosis, yeah. But it's not. I'm not going to diagnose it now. I'm just going to say.
The word reflect, isn't it?
In some way reflect the phenomenology of experience. I mean, what's given to the subject is the phenomenology, so the idea that it might in some way reflect it is is an understatement.
Yeah.
So can I carry on, because I'm not doing this seminar thing, I'm giving, because I want to finish in the time that I've been, because I'm a time fascist. So, and then otherwise Dan will stop me, and then I'll feel bad. Anyway, that's Siegel's view. So I say, what? Given that the line of thought that we've been trying to describe is, first of all, you say content of experience is what's conveyed to the subject. That's thought of as representational. That's thought of as propositional. then you say, along with Chalmers, you might say, well, there are multiple propositions and you can have many contents. Then the question arises, well, what's that got to do with phenomenology? Then you have this remark, we're saying, well, actually, intentionalism is a phenomenological theory. Now I want to know what that's got to do with the multiple relations to the different propositions. So I agree, it's a confusing situation, and this is what... But nonetheless, it's widely held that what is taken in a certain sense, what is taken in experience, and I have this kind of give and take picture, so, you know, the world gives and you take. The world's all about giving and you just take, that's what my mother used to say. So, you treat this place like a hotel. I think the answer to this question, the question I just raised, what's this got to do with propositions, is that what is taken in experience is propositional in character, in the sense that what you take in is something that can be true or false. This is actually something explicitly said by John McDowell, who's not a standard intentionist, but has this particular conception of it, when he says one takes in, for instance, sees that things are thus and so. That is the sort of thing one can also, for instance, judge. So for him, it's very important that what you can see to be the case is also something that you can judge. That's incredibly important to his whole view, because there's this problem that he's trying to solve, which is how experience can justify belief, and he thinks that experience can only justify belief if the content of your experience is also the sort of thing that you can come to believe. So that's just evidence for the view that there is this view that what is taken in is phenomenological. It's propositional. Now, in a recent paper, Mark Johnson has attacked this idea, and I think what he says is very interesting. He calls the intentionalist view the fact-directed view. This isn't a good description of the view, actually, because it turns out that, you know, an intentionalist view, the content of experience is something that could be true or false. A fact is not something that could be true or false. If anything, a fact is a truth. Then it's something that could have been false, even if it's true. Let's not worry about that. I'm just nitpicking. So what he means by the fact-directed view is the standard intentionalist view. He says the standard intentionalist view does not earn the right to the metaphor of the senses taking in concrete reality. So he says that Johnson's view, the first part of his paper argues that we should take seriously this idea that the senses, that in perception the senses take in reality, and what should we make of this? And he says that the fact-directed view isn't entitled to say this. He says, because concrete reality does not consist of items that could have been false. Acts of sensory awareness are most naturally understood as directed not at facts, by which he means true propositions, but at spatio-temporal particulars, that is, objects or stuff of some kind, or events or states of some sort. I think the important point there is that acts of sensory awareness are directed at spatio-temporal particulars. I don't think it's important that it's particulars, but it's the spatio-temporal element. There's some idea that's the concrete reality bit, so your senses are directed at concrete reality. Now, there's some things that are right about this and some things that are wrong, just seem to me wrong, and just, but in an interesting way. I mean, there's an echo of the flat-footed Wittgensteinian response that says that what's going on here is that we see propositions, right? That's what the intentionalist view says. Of course, the standard intentionist view, like Burns' view or Tye's view, can say that experience takes in concrete reality. In the sense, what it takes in is the objects of experience, the things around us, the objects and properties that we see. And these are items in concrete reality when we see them. what I mean is, when we succeed in seeing something, what we succeed in seeing is an item in concrete reality. The thesis is that the senses take in concrete reality by generating states with propositional content. That's the intentionalist thesis that I'm talking about. And it doesn't, it's not committed to the view that we see propositions, which is an absurd view. Nonetheless, so I think that, that there's a lack of sympathetic reading of his opponent here, but nonetheless I think Johnson's view is onto something, which is this. The phenomenology of experience is vision. In the case, I'm talking about vision here, so the phenomenology of vision is the senses taking in concrete reality. And surely that this idea of taking in concrete reality has to have something to do with the intuitive idea of what is given to the subject in experience. What is given is what is taken in. This is my give and take principle. I say, well, since what is given is what is, taken in, what's that got to do with the concrete reality that you see? So this is where I want to say, suggest that the standard intentionalist view breaks the link between content, its particular use of content, and what is really conveyed to the subject, which is what it, which is concrete reality when it, that's taken in. And that's what seems to me to be right about Johnson's view and the grain of truth in the flat-footed Wittgensteinian criticism. The problem for standard intentionalism, then, as I'm calling it, is that how intentionalists can hope to explain the phenomenology of experience in terms of content in their sense. Since intentionalism was supposed to be a theory of the phenomenology of experience. I mean, I think it's particularly vivid if you think in Chalmers terms, you think of the content pluralist view, because then there's no one thing that is given to you. There's no unity to any of this thing. There are just different ways of describing the your experience by relating it to different kinds of abstract objects. But even if you didn't think that, even if you thought that what was given to you was a Russellian proposition, what was conveyed to you was a Russellian proposition, how is that supposed to be related to taking in concrete reality? That's the question for the intentionalist. Well, I think that there is, that the way to go on this is to think about content in a different way. And by content here I mean what is conveyed to the subject in experience. So I'm agreeing on the basic definition of that term that that Siegel introduced. If we think of what is taken in experience as concrete reality, it's concrete reality presented in some way rather than another. So if you think, whenever you see something, you're seeing it from some angle in some conditions of illumination. You're not seeing all of it as if that were possible. You see something by seeing its surface. You see things in shadow in various aspects, as I want to put it, following Husserl. Is something when I would agree with non-representationalist philosophers like Travis or Bill Brewer, who want to say that we should think of experience first and foremost in terms of a relation to the things around us and the way that those things, the particular ways in which those things stand in those relations are give the particular character of the experience. That's a non-representationist view, but I want to be a representationist or intentionalist, so it's the same thing. I want to be an intentionalist because, for the reason that I said to Sam, that I think that you can be in the same state of mind even if you aren't standing in any relation to anything. So the nature of your state of mind cannot consist in a relation to those things. And so I say concrete reality need not be that way in order for it to be represented in that way. So I could have an experience which was exactly the same as the experience I'm having now, in all its specificity and detail, even if none of you were there. Of course, that's not physically possible. No one ever has had such an experience. But I think it's a metaphysical possibility that's contained within our idea of experience. So that's why I'm a representationist. It's nothing to do with the transparency of experience, which I agree with Sam is a bad argument and doesn't establish anything. So I say that the representational content of the experience in this sense is how the world is taken in the experience, where, but I put taken in inverted commas there because I want taken in not to commit there to actually being a world just by having an experience of that nature. But what I want to say is that that's not a proposition. What's taken in this representational sense, is just the representation of things around you. And that's not something which is a proposition, that representation of things around you. The contrast, you might say, well, why isn't this a proposition? I said proposition is something that's true or false. And here I want to draw a distinction, which again I take from inspiration from Husserl's early work, and the distinction between the real content of an experience, where real means concrete, actually it means spatiotemporal in the actual act itself, the thing that was actually contained within the mental act of experiencing something, and the ideal content. Now ideal in this terminology means abstract in the contemporary analytic terminology, so non-spatiotemporal. And abstract is a good word because it's an abstraction away from the real concrete given that's given, that's actually a constituent of the mental state itself. That's the real content. Now the real content could be called the concrete content, but I haven't quite worked out this terminology yet, because there's a sense in which, you know, you could say sets of possible worlds are concrete in some sense, or Russellian propositions are concrete. I want to put all that to one side, because what I want to say is there's something that you do with propositions which is abstracting from the individual specificity, particularity and idiosyncrasy of a one person's particular experience. And that's why propositions are the subject matter of logic, because in order for them to be the subject matter of logic, they have to be common across many different mental acts. And that's what the content of experience in this other sense that I'm talking about now is not. The content of experience is specific to this very mental act at this moment. So if you take the case of the proposition that the cat is on, if you say the cat is on the mat, has various logical properties, and depending on what you think the logical form is, but you know, you might think that it has the property of entailing that something is on the mat, or that the cat is on something, or that something is on something. And these are logical implications of the proposition that the cat is on the mat. These are indifferent to all the very particular, specific, concrete ways in which the particular cat is on the particular mat at this moment. But the particular cat being on this particular mat at this moment, that's the kind of thing that you take in experience. You take in the particularity of the world around you, not something abstracted from that or generalized from that. And so here I'm trying to say things that Charles Travis might say, but in a different voice, I think. Sam's decided to record this, so I won't give a Charles Travis impression on this. No, I can. Later. You have to wait. So this idea, the idea that the way that the particular cat is on this particular mat at the moment, that's something in concrete reality. That's something that you take in experience. And that's the thing, the way that particular cat is on that particular mat, the way it's represented as being on that particular cat, on that particular mat, that's what the content of experience is in this sense. And I see this as the concrete content, or perhaps I'm worried about this word concrete now, but I think I want to say that this is, in Husserl's sense, the real content of the experience, or the matter of the experience. That's Husserl. Right. You see, I think there's a connection here with the debate about psychologism. Psychologism about logic, I mean, here. Because the two aspects of this, of the criticism in Frege and Husserl of psychologism about logic, which is not something I know an enormous amount about, but have just been discovering. One is that logic could not concern the contents of consciousness. So you can't have a psychological explanation of logic, because logic cannot be about, it cannot be a description of psychological processes, and it can't be the laws of thought in that sense. And one reason is that individual psychological episodes are all too specific, idiosyncratic, and you know, they have spatiotemporal qualities, duration, and all these things, which are a matter of complete indifference to logic, to the subject matter of logic. And the other reason is that, it's related really, it's that the ideal content of a mental act, which I'm going to call the propositional content, is an ideal content, it's an abstract content, is a generalization, is something that's generalized from many mental acts, and could be the content, in the ideal sense, of many different mental acts. So this is why we want to say belief is a relation to a proposition, because you can infer all sorts of things from saying belief is a relation to a proposition, which you couldn't infer if you thought of a belief as a kind of just a sort of non-relational intrinsic state that was a sort of fused nature, which is some point that Fodor and others made many years ago. Propositions are abstractions, idealizations, away from the concrete messiness of actual experience. And that's how logic is possible. So I think of standard intentionalism. I mean, of course, anti-psychologism about logic is right. You cannot have a psychologistic reduction of logic. That's an advance. It's an advance to say that, and we will never go back there. Well, we probably will, actually, because philosophy always goes back to these really bad ideas, but we shouldn't go back there. Anti-psychologism about logic is right, but I say standard intentionalism is anti-psychologism about the psychological, because it takes this idea of something which is an abstraction from the psychological reality and treats that as if it's what is conveyed to the subject in their experience. This is my diagnosis of this, which is rather superficial, but perhaps I could make it less superficial. Because when the notion of content of experience was introduced, the only notion that they had to employ here was the notion of propositional content, which was used in the theory of the propositional attitudes or propositional logic, and people thought that they understood this kind of thing. So when you introduce the notion of propositional content, then where did you have to go to look for it apart from in the theory of propositional attitudes? But this is where I say that propositional content gives no account of proper account of what is given to the subject. Not because of qualia. I think of qualia as an irrelevance here. I mean, I can agree with a lot of what people say about qualia. It's just I don't think there's any need to use the word. That's my view. But that's another whole issue. The propositional content gives no adequate account of what is given to the subject for the reason that I said above. The better picture then that I prefer is to think of the concrete content of the experience, the real content of the experience, as in a certain sense non-conceptual. In what sense? I mean that the notion of a concept fundamentally has its home in reasoning and judgment and belief. And that predicating something, making a judgment where you predicate something of something, is employing a concept to talk about the world. So certainly when you see a whole bunch of things, you see this room, the layout of this room around you, you can isolate some bit of it. And I could say, Tony is wearing a blue shirt. And I can think that, and I can attend to Tony, just as one aspect, one part of my experience. I can attend to Tony and I can predicate wearing a blue shirt of him. That's a conceptual. It's a conceptual act. It involves conceptualizing Tony and predicating something of him. To say that experience is non-conceptual in this sense is just to say there's no such thing as predicating something in an experience. Experience doesn't predicate. Experience doesn't make judgments. Experience just is the taking in of concrete reality. Of course, that says nothing about the mechanisms of experience and how, you know, of course, there is categorization and classification which is done by the visual system, What I'm talking about here is not that, because that's not the operation of concepts either, because that's at the, I guess, the subpersonal level in Dennett's sense. So it's in this sense, I think, that the content of experience is non-conceptual. I think that Peacock's idea of a scenario is one way of developing this, but I won't go into that because I'm running short of time. But what's interesting is that the opposition to the idea that experience is non-conceptual has come from John McDowell and his followers, and some of the opposition to this. And as I said, McDowell said in the 1990s in his book Mind and World, he said that it was very important for his view that what you see, when you see that something is the case, what you see that is, what you see to be the case is also something that you can judge. Now, if these ideas about the real or concrete content of experience that I'm talking about now are anyway on the right lines, then that can't be right, that what you see to be the case is something that you can judge. Judgment might be, say, a product of attention. And attention can be conceptually driven and can be driven by higher cognitive processes. So you tend to something because you want to look at it more. Needn't necessarily be like that, but it often is. And then when you attend to something, then you can make a judgment about it. But that's not what you judge. Then is that something is true, or something is the case, and that's not the kind of thing that you can see to be the case. I say. So McDowell's view is deeply wrong. The McDowell 1994 view is deeply wrong, for at least for that reason. I mean, I think for another reason too. I've been persuaded by Charles Travis that seeing that something is the case, does not always report a perceptual achievement. It can often report something which is entirely non-perceptual achievement, and you can give a unified, not that Travis would want to do this, but you could give a unified account of seeing that something is the case in terms of epistemic notions like knowing that something is the case on the basis of seeing, or coming to know that something is the case on the basis of seeing. So in that sense, it can be in exactly the same sense that I see that Tom is wearing a red shirt as the sense that I can see that that Tom is in pain. I can literally see that Tom is in pain, not because I have some spooky capacity to peer into his Cartesian soul, but because I can come to know that he is in pain on the basis of what I see, just as I can come to know that he's wearing a red shirt on the basis of what I can see. Someone who didn't have the concept of red, someone who didn't know what a shirt was, could see what I can see, but they cannot come to know on the basis of seeing that Tom is wearing a red shirt. And that's why I say it's not a distinctively perceptual achievement. Now, what's interesting about John McDowell, for John McDowell followers or John McDowell watchers, or for the faithful, is that he's changed his mind on this. He hasn't told us he's changed his mind. He's told us that that's what he meant all along. This is the way philosophers change their mind, right? Apart from admirable exceptions like Bertrand Russell and Hilary Putnam. There are these philosophers who tell you, they say P one day, then 20 years later they say not P, and then they say, oh no, P was what I meant all along when I said P. Right, so this is what McDowell says now in his dispute with Dreyfus, and this is really for the enthusiasts, as Chris Peacock would say. But McDowell said, and I'm pleased that he gives this description of the situation which seems to me to be true about the relationship between experience and conceptual capacity. It says, some of what an experience discloses to us about the world is embraced by conceptual capacities that we already had before we had words for those aspects of what was disclosed. But he says, surely some of the content of a typically rich world-disclosing experience never makes its way into constituting part of the content of the repertoire of conceptual capacities in that sense, he says. And that seems to me to be, that's a description of what I was, just to vainly refer to myself for a moment, sorry. Well, that's a description of what I was trying to, struggling to articulate in 1992 when I wrote a paper on the non-conceptual content of experience. That's what I wanted to say. Some of the content of our world-disclosing experience never makes its way into this constituting part of the content of our repertoire of conceptual capacities. I mean, it just means that there's so much more in experience than could be the content of a conceptual capacity. And that's one of the differences between experience and thought. And that picture that McDowell now has come up with is very congenial to the conceptual content that I now would like to persuade you of. Finally, then, the question is, what is the role of propositions in this picture? Let me just say this briefly. Does this mean that propositions have no use? I say no. That's it. I'm not against propositional content. I'm not against that idea. I'm not even against the idea of assigning propositional contents to experience. That's something that you can do. What propositions do, it seems to me, is some, and this is, seems to me there was a truth in an old idea of Lewis's when he said that we should think of the abstract propositions as standing in the same kind of relation to concrete mental states as numbers stand to physical magnitudes. So you can use them to model the condition of certain physical systems by exploiting the properties of the abstract objects that we know and seeing how they relate to one another. And of course this is then an idealization, because you might say propositions have all these logical entailments which our mental states cannot possibly reproduce, but that's the point of logic then being a norm of thought rather than a description of human thought. So this is the idea of modeling, that you assign abstract objects of various kinds to mental states, and relationships among these objects may or may not parallel relations among the mental states themselves. I could talk more about that discussion if you like. So propositions would be part of a model of the mental in this sense, and nothing wrong with that. And content pluralism then would allow different kinds of contents to be used in different models. I mentioned Oedipus because this is a clear kind of case of those who know the discussions of de re and de dicto attributions of propositional attitudes. You know, if you ask the question, did Oedipus want to marry his mother? You want to say, well, you know, in a sense he did, in a sense he didn't. Right? He wouldn't have put it that way himself, but after all, the fact that he wanted to marry his mother is part of the tragedy. So you want to get some way of expressing those differences, and you can use different propositions to model different aspects of this total mental state. So what I want to say then in conclusion is that there are really two notions of content that we could use in talking about mental states and talking about experience. Although these aren't two notions of what is given to the subject or conveyed to the subject, these are two ways in which the thing is being used. There's a semantic conception where we use ideal contents, propositions to model mental states. But there's a more fundamental phenomenological conception, I say, of content. Content is the concrete way that the experienced concrete reality is represented in certain mental states. Now I want to say that the phenomenological conception has certain priority, because that's what's being modeled. What's being modeled is the whole concrete act, the real act with its intention, what Husserl called the intentional quality in the matter. And that's where semantic contents in the semantic sense, propositions, can only be descriptions of this real content, the concrete content. So then the lesson for intentionism then finally is that I think that the idea of what's conveyed to the subject should not be understood in terms of propositional content. That the phenomenal character and experience cannot be identified with, a fortiori, cannot be identified with its propositional content in the way some people say, some intentionalists say, the phenomenal character and experience is identical with the propositional content of the experience. That idea is confused in so many ways, but I've given another way in which it's confused. The intentionist instead should aim to give an account of what I'm calling, although I haven't settled on this terminology yet, the concrete phenomenological content. And that's the end. Thank you very much. Sam, do you want to record this too?
Is that okay?
The discussion.
Is that okay?
Sure.
You know, how do we put the light shut?
Yes. Oh. Yeah.